Welcome to this Writers at Warwick sponsored event. It gives me great pleasure to welcome our two distinguished speakers here tonight. And the theme of this evening's readings is the interplay between literary and scientific modes of engaging with the world and with the process of artistic creation. In his recent book, The One Culture, A Conversation About Science, Harry Collins issued a warning about the dangers of overstepping boundaries. And I quote, "Artists and critics are not always the best of friends. Those who cannot do, but still take it upon themselves to analyze, should tread carefully." Well, our two speakers tonight have considerable experience of both doing and analyzing, as well as sharing an open interdisciplinary outlook that aims to include both literary and scientific perspectives on the world. First of all, I'll introduce Lisa Pignanese. She is a very distinguished voice in all manner of fields, and has published a great many number of novels, as well as scholarly books working on Freud, on Proust, on Henry James. She's worked on femininity, she's worked on cabaret, she's worked on postmodernism, and recently, and perhaps most pertinently for this evening, she has collaborated with the biologist Stephen Rose, editing a collection called Science and Beyond, and has recently also been involved in all kinds of interesting research for her latest book, The Memory Man, from which she'll be reading tonight. Robert Crawford is a leading Scottish poet who is Professor of English at the University of St Andrews, Fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, and a founding Fellow of the English Association. His texts involve criticism of the devolution of English literature, about identity within poetry, and he has published several collections of poetries, including Spirit Machines, and is currently working on a collection of poems called The Tip of My Tongue, which should be published later on this year. He's also editing a collection of essays on contemporary poetry and science, which is connected with a series of events connected by the Poetry House, which he may well be talking to you about later on this evening. So the format for this evening's event is that first Lisa will be reading a few passages from some of her works, then we'll pass the floor over to Robert, and then we'll take open questions to both of our speakers at the end of the session.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, Charlotte. I think I scare even myself now. For those of you who are at all familiar with my work, you'll know that I've long been interested in the subject of memory from a variety of perspectives. And indeed, in science, I'm really rather ignorant about science. It did come up in some of my books, and I had to go and do very specific research for that, and then as soon as I had done it, I'd forget it. In the last few years, I've had the wonderful opportunity, through the goodwill of the Gulbenkian Partnerships in the Arts and Science, of becoming a science stalker, because Stephen Rose asked me if I would be his partner in one of these arts science twosomes. And he, as you know, is a biochemist and neuroscientist who works at the Open University in the Brain and Behavior Research Lab. Now, I say all this because although I had this novel in mind before I started doing work with Stephen, what happened there has influenced it in many ways. This is a book which is now called The Memory Man. He appears in the book, not in the section I'm going to read you, but he appears in it because I thought if I didn't put him in, everybody would think that the main character of the book, one of the main characters, was indeed him. He's not. I'm telling you this right now. What I wanted to do in this book, to a certain extent, was to use some of the neuroscientific understanding of memory and somehow to see where and how and if it coincided with our experience of remembering and forgetting from the inside. In other words, it's an attempt to look at the inner life vis-a-vis the world of knowledge and science about these things. That's the intellectual theme. It's also a story. And I'm going to read to you from it from the very beginning. It's really the first time I've read from this book. As you see, it's still in manuscript. It's not yet out. And so I hope you'll forgive me if it sometimes sounds, or sometimes not reading as well as I ought. And you'll stop me after the requisite time. Had Bruno Lindt known what awaited him when he returned to the city of his birth, he might not have made the journey. As it was, he wasn't quite sure what had brought him to visit a Vienna he hadn't set foot in since childhood. He put it down in the first instance to an old man's vanity. The city that had once chased him away was now wooing him back. He relished the whiff of perversity in the city fathers having remembered him because they were holding a conference on memory. He was a scientist of considerable reputation and more years. Not that he suffered from them unduly. He prided himself on the fact that his limbs still carried him unaided, that the pull of gravity wasn't yet excessive, and that he didn't normally experience a blind panic when trying to retrieve a name or a bit of knowledge from the recesses of his mind. The deposits the years had left on his brain still seemed to allow some current through, and thoughts were produced. The only difficulty was that he had the sense time was running, and running out at an ever-quickening pace. And the past had begun to haunt him, sometimes plague him with its unfinished business. At the Vienna airport, a man with a bristling moustache came to meet him. He carried an identifying sign which bore the word memory in curling Gothic print in three languages above Bruno's name. He didn't laugh when Bruno said he was happy he had remembered to collect him. In fact, he gave the distinct impression that none of the three languages on the sign were his own. Driving, not conversation, nor jokes, was his business, and he drove a large limousine with sedate pomp. Bruno was left to his own devices. He leaned back in his seat and with a hint of reluctance looked out the window. The city rose into view through some internal mist, then quivered into dim familiarity. Bruno stared at old narrow streets, at buildings of pale stone, at arched, sculpture-strewn doorways, at voluptuous goddesses and expansive gods, at graceful domes and vaulting spires. He began to feel they were hieroglyphs in a lost language, poised to reveal a long-hidden secret he hadn't known they contained. The animated hotel roused him. The lobby was a confusion of voices and tongues, muted only by the chocolate box padding of walls and curtains and chairs. Luggage trolleys purred across thick carpets. Youths in dove-grey uniforms signaled to straying guests. Beside Bruno, a woman with an operatic bosom insisted on tickets for that evening's performance of Parsifal. The pert curly-haired attendant behind the registration desk welcomed Bruno with respectful enthusiasm, adding the Herr Doktor Professor to his own unadored lint, and smiling as if she had been waiting for no one else all morning. She explained that his hosts had graced him with their best suite, that if anything was not to his satisfaction, he should ring immediately. Bruno returned her smile with a cordiality he was, in fact, beginning to feel under the shower of her attention. It was in the midst of all this, while she was handing him his key and a brochure, that he heard the name, heard it from behind, so that it insinuated itself into his mind and clutched at him like some tentacle born from the reverie the streets had induced, and now given a vivid, unnatural daytime life. Alexander Tarski. The syllables coiled round him and forced him to turn. Somewhere in him, it seemed, the fear was still alive, despite the passage of years. He stumbled, had to lean against the counter to catch breath and composure, like the old man he stubbornly refused to be. What was that name doing here, rolling off a woman's lips and abutting in a question? What was it doing here, ahead of him? He now saw that the syllables had been tentatively aimed at a man who had just risen from one of the silk-cushioned armchairs. He was tall, really far too lank-haired and bedraggled to be standing in this hotel with his veneered pretensions to good taste and better discretion. The woman was more in tune with her surroundings, a slim, rather angular creature with a haughty expression and a long, flower-like neck. She was carefully suited and coiffed, yet nervous, judging by the hesitation in her voice. The tall man acknowledged that the name had found a home. Bruno relaxed a little. He was curious now and followed the couple with his eyes. This particular Tarski had a soft, slightly distracted air, despite the large features and cavernous jaw. His hair was of an indefinite colour. His shoulders and the worn tweed jacket sloped slightly as he allowed the woman to lead him away. He was both too old and too young, Bruno judged, though judging people was no longer what he did best. He took the mirrored lift up to the fourth floor. In his room, he pushed the thick brocade curtain aside and opened the window. The excited noise of the narrow pedestrian street rose towards him. He watched the scurry of passers-by for a moment, then stretched out on the bed and closed his eyes. A brief rest would restore him. But there was no rest. Images from the dream that had plagued him this last while leapt before him with the grainy effect of a battered old film on a repeating loop. Figures kept falling, one after another, larger and smaller. Their faces were turned away from him. They refused recognition. The ground opened beneath them, making a short fall into a terrifying drop. Deeper and deeper they fell, against razor's sharp granite walls, so that he had to open his eyes to stop the plunge and the barrage of German voices which accompanied it, like the deafening, incomprehensible rumble of gunfire. Bruno rose to look out the window once more. The Graben, of course. The name of the street came back to him. Grave, that's what it meant. It really had been one in the plague years. Someone had told him that. It struck him that only the Viennese would turn a communal trench into one of their principal pedestrian arteries, a pleasure haunt for consumers positioned on top of a mass grave. Tarski. That name, overheard in the lobby, had come back from the grave too, like some dusty ancient dig. He now contained generations of graves, some shallow, some vertiginously deep. Had he been right to come here? After so many years pretending the place had nothing to do with him, not only the place, the whole region, Central Europe, a cemetery. For years he had been a Canadian, a Californian, a Bostonian, a New Yorker, latterly even a Londoner, which might be a little closer, anything but a Viennese. And above all, he had been a scientist, which made him part of a country without borders or geography. Bruno glanced at the conference brochure the hotel clerk had handed him. His own face stared out at him in full color. Blue eyes glinted. The shock of white hair rose from a face where the lines were deeply etched, a roadmap of the character he had become. Uncanny how it was, it didn't feel like his own image. Like some self-deluding woman, he never altogether recognized himself anymore. He skimmed the details of his long scientific career and the praise he had submitted of the keynote speech he would deliver this evening. He had a need to familiarize himself with a life which here, now, no longer quite felt like his own. They would have robbed him of it. But they, he reminded himself, were no longer here. The organizers had deftly noted his Viennese birth alongside the list of honors and titles he had become. Of course, he had had no illusions when he accepted the invitation that this was a meeting with a difference, a conference with an only slightly hidden political intent. He would allude to that in his sides. Keeper of the new analog neurosteroids, which promised so much for the aging individual's cognitive powers, he had been brought here to prod Austria's sluggish, often faulty collective memory into action. Or at least to make it appear to the rest of Europe that Austria wanted to prod at it a little herself, so as to become an acceptable member of the wider community. He leafed through the pages of the brochure. There were open sessions aimed at a general public and closed presentations geared specifically at the scientists. Some of the usual suspects were here with papers on semantic dementia and cognitive amnesia, the different processes involved in knowing and remembering. There were others on aspects of synaptic plasticity, the cellular correlate for learning and memory, on APP-related peptides, on intracellular calcium and caspase cascades, on Alzheimer's plaques and tangles and APOE, that molecular chaperone that many thought escorted the evil beta amyloid through the brain. The field had so burgeoned in this last decade that even its supposed members sometimes had difficulty understanding each other. It was a far cry from the naive and all too general question which had seemed so urgent all those years back and which had propelled him into memory work. Why was it that although our brain cells are always changing, we remember even when we want to forget? But the world had been transformed since then. Wanting to forget had been replaced by wanting to remember. Maybe there were too many products on the market, products which didn't count as pharmaceuticals, to induce oblivion. Even if not always reliably. Alcohol, cannabis, a welter of harder drugs plunged you into the welcome waters of lethe, more or less at will. As for enhancing the mnesic function, when it had grown recalcitrant, there was nothing yet to deal with that. Except, perhaps, his lab's synthetic neurosteroids, which had done well so far on the rats. Viagra for the brain, one of the competing labs had dubbed the compound, though he himself was far more cautious, slightly worried, too, about the hype which had infiltrated even his world. Bruno searched down the participants list until he found the name that had sent him reeling in the hotel lobby, a pharmacologist from the Academy of Sciences in Krakow. He was leading one of the parallel sessions on Alzheimer's, Professor Alexander Tarski. The name hadn't been on the original participants' lists. Or had he somehow missed it? Or far more troubling, subliminally seen it and still come here? As so often these days, when personal life grew too troubling, he reached for Lynn's lexicon, his mental beginner's guide to matters neural. There was nothing like a definition of a physiological or biochemical kind to wield or hide behind in order to cut those inner demons down to size. Now, I should tell you, this book is interspersed for much of its length, not all of it, with Lynn's lexicon, which is this beginner's guide to matters neural. And I think it's probably quite hard to read these sections out, but they come in sort of blocks. I'll read you the first one in any case. This is Lynn's lexicon on seeing. And the character Bruno uses these as a way not to think, but to think in parallel terms about what he doesn't want to think about. So, seeing. I need my glasses for this because it's tiny. Images form on the retina and are carried as signals by neurons, down axons, and across a number of electrochemical synapses to a staging region. If this puts you to sleep, just put your hands up and I'll stop. It's really very interesting, but it's hard to read out loud. Images form on the retina and are carried as signals by neurons, down axons, and across a number of electrochemical synapses to a staging region, the lateral geniculate nucleus. and then on into the primary visual cortex located at the back of the brain in the occipital lobe. Two types of neurotransmitters are active in the visual cortex, ferrying or slowing the movement of information across the synaptic gap, the excitatory glutamate released by spiny dendrites and the inhibitory GABA released by the smooth. The visual cortex itself is divided into subsystems or modules, each of which has a separate function, to detect motion, color, directionality, edges, lines, and thus shape. These cortices communicate with one another. Lesions or damage in these subsystems can lead to a variety of conditions. For example, loss of the ability to see color, a draining away into a universe of varying shades of gray, or to what is known as blind sight, where patients can point to streams of light they profess not to see. Since there are far more retinal neurons than there are optic nerves, there is a compression of information from the retina to the geniculate. There are no images as such in the brain, only topographically organized representations, new ones triggering the old, and so on in an associative pattern. Nor is there a homunculus who determines what is attended to or remembered. This necessitates the action of other brain regions, including the temporal, parietal, and frontal lobes. How perceptual filtering takes place is not yet clear, though recent experiments using brain imaging techniques have shown that already at the level of the visual cortex, distinctions of salience are made within the mass of information that is coming in from the eye. This salience is affected by information coming from other brain regions, including hormonal and serotonergic elements. Back to story. Before he realized he had quite made up his mind to it, Bruno Lindt was out in the streets and hurrying along with no particular destination. He needed to walk. He needed it more than he needed to return the two voice messages which had been waiting for him. Stillness wasn't his natural mode, though too often of late he found himself in it, probably because his future was now all in the past. The Vienna air was close with the closeness of landlocked climates, slightly fetid with its very distance from sea. The sky above was too bright. He let the jostle of the quick-paced crowd propel him and found himself in front of Demel's. The cafe window brimmed with an astonishing assortment of moulded pastries and rich cream cakes. In a moment, like some child who had been given permission, he found himself greedily inside amidst the imperial grandeur of chandeliers and highly polished wood and a pervasive smell of chocolate. He wondered at the eerie sense of familiarity the place induced in him, despite the dizzying passage of years. The menu still wore the imperial design of the dual monarchy the café had served, Ka und Ka, Kakania, imperial and royal. His father had explained so very long ago, and simultaneously made it a word to giggle over in modern republican times. Bruno ordered Sachertorte and a mélange, half thinking that the first might serve as Proust's Madeleine for him, though it would probably only give him indigestion, and not because he had secretly to confess that he had never read the greatest of the literary memory men. The scales didn't fall from his eyes with the first bite, and investors passed with new meaning. Even though it was a scientific truth now wrested from nature, that taste and smell did indeed lay down some of the earliest synaptic connections. Maybe recollection was the last thing he needed to focus on in his time off. Far better to glory in the sheer sumptuousness of chocolate, so often self-denied, rich, fragrant chocolate mingled with the tart sweetness of apricot jam. And then there's a little insert on from Lindt's lexicon on taste and smell, which I don't think I'll read to you, but it's there. Bruno picked a newspaper off a corner rack and was surprised to find that he had selected a local one, not the Herald Tribune displayed with equal prominence. He learned that the right-wing Austrian Freedom Party, which so blithely married alpenstocks to laptops, nationalism to grasping professionalism, had embarked on a new patriotic strategy. In their leader, Jörg Haider's stronghold of Carinthia, the road signs would announce only destinations outside the country, presumably so that any of those South Slav foreigners could find their way quickly home, or at least to Italy, without any prolonged stay in the pure local villages. Bruno was suddenly aware of the people around him. Apart from the evident tourists, they were mostly old, like him, even older, thin-lipped but jowly, with small suspicious eyes, their clothes far too warm for the season. A voice screamed inside him. "What were you doing all those years ago? Did you eat cream cakes while others were torn from their families? Shot? Did you hold the gun?" He dropped some notes on the table and raced out. On the street, a young woman caught his gaze, a young woman with red-gold hair and a spattering of freckles. It came to him that she was addressing the same questions to him as he had to the Demel's clientele. He was the right generation, after all, old enough to be her grandfather. He laughed out loud and earned some curious looks. He wondered if he passed as a native. Could one say of a country abandoned at the age of 10 that it was one's native land? Others seemed to think so. But so many places liked to claim him when they chose, when his particular assets suited. Canada, the US, now Britain. They could just as easily not choose, of course, could choose instead to close ranks and call him foreigner. Like these men on a bench here, raggedy, smoking, too dark for native taste, cast out, outcasts. That name, encountered with no forewarning, had thrust him into a strange state, that was for sure. He even felt now that he emerged from enclosed streets to the vast neoclassical grandeur of the Heldenplatz, that he had grown smaller and needed an adult hand to cling onto. He felt insubstantial, powerless. He had to force himself to look up at the curving facade of the newest imperial palace, finished too late for the Habsburgs, but in time for that malevolent usurper of power to stand on its column terrace and declare the unification of Austria and Germany. Anschluss. He may not have witnessed Hitler's rallying cry to the Austrians then, but somehow it had etched itself with pictorial realism on his mind, so that he could see the huge massed crowds, the arms lifted in salutes, hear the raucous, hate-filled voice, the stomp of boots beating out a unified rhythm. Like New Yorkers who vividly remember the destruction of the Twin Towers as a real event, whereas in fact they had only witnessed it virtually. Did the brain distinguish between registering real death from real-time death, as death on television was oddly called? The answer probably lay in the level of fear recurring. Sorry, of fear, recurring fear. It was soon after the Anschluss that his father had disappeared. He had never returned. Bruno was no longer sure he had missed him at the time. Not right away, in any case. There were his mother and his sister to tend to. With his father gone, he was the man of the house, self-important despite his short trousers. He reveled in the new responsibility. But later, much later, when he was already in his 40s, older than his father had been at the time of his disappearance, an acute sadness had taken him over. It was when the San Diego lab had won that huge investment he had all at once recalled for the first time that it was his father who had first shown him a drawing of a nerve cell so intricately branched that it trapped the eye like a lure. Am I all right? It was early spring. They had all spent the day in the country, a family picnic. At one point, he and his father had lain under a tree together and looked up, marveling at the intricate fretwork of boughs and branches not yet in leaf, through which the sky glowed a deep, clear blue. When they got home that evening, his father had pulled a thick book from his library shelves and shown him a delicate drawing which repeated the spread of branches and boughs. This, his father had told him, is a neuron, a cell in your brain. Bruno had gazed at the sponge-sugar delicacy of the drawing, a mysterious tracery which his father told him mirrored the complexity of human thought. Yes, it was his father who had infected him with the excitement of science, had even way back then talked of sending him to the technically progressive Realschule instead of the more classical gymnasium. Perhaps it was he who had spoken of science as a search for principles of law and order in the universe. Perhaps not. Bruno no longer knew. He wasn't looking at the palace anymore. He was walking quickly, his summer jacket ruched, his hands balled and fists, walking with his head down like an angry lad or an absent-minded don. He walked past chestnut-lined gardens and statuary, bronze horsemen and flower beds, past regal churches and towering spires, past a roll call of names, Bankgasse, Lowellstrasse, Schottengasse, Währingstrasse. How he arrived at the particular street with its uniform stone buildings, he didn't know. His body had taken him, and it was the sudden slope that alerted him, memory triggered by his legs along ancient pathways to the cerebellum. He was staring up past decorated stonework, at a second-floor window, which was home. The curtain fluttered. A woman appeared, her soft gold-brown hair curled slightly at the shoulders. Her summer dress was flowered, and as she reached up to unlatch the window, her bare arm glimmered smooth in the sunlight. "Mami, mamusha," his lips formed round the syllables. Warmth coursed through his veins, a happy anticipation. He waved, prepared to race into the courtyard and up the stairs. And then there was a kick and thud at the back of his knees. He crumbled. The building heaved and turned upside down. He started to shout, shouted louder, but the shouting didn't reach his mouth, which had gone bone dry. The screams exploded in his head instead, one explosion with each kick and thump in his stomach, his groin, his back, his face. Each punch came with a punctuation of vile curses he wasn't allowed to use. I'll stop there.
When proof of Einstein's Glaswegian birth first hit the media, everything else was dropped. Logie Baird, Dundee Painters, David Hume, all got the big E. Scott's publishers, physics documentaries became peak viewing. Scott's publishers hurled a war McDermid like an overbaked potato and swooped on the memorabilia. Einstein used my fruit shop. Einstein in old postcards. Einstein's Bear's Den relatives. Hot on their heels came the A.E. Fun Park, Quantum Court, Glen Einstein, Highland Malt. Glasgow was booming. Scotland rose to its feet at Albert's suppers, where the toast to the general theory was given by footballers, panto dames, or restaurateurs. In the U.S., an aging lab technician recorded how the great man, when excited, showed a telltale glottal stop. He'd loved fiddler's rallies. His favourite sport was curling. Thanks to this, Scottish business expanded endlessly. His head grew Toby jug-shaped, ideal for keyrings. He'd always worn brogues, ate bannocks in exile. As a wee boy, he'd read the Beano. His name brought new energy. Our culture was solidly based on pride in our hero, the universal Scott. I'm glad you laughed at that. That's the only funny poem I'm going to read tonight. It seems odd to... I'm just going to read poems that in some sense relate to science, which I've not done before. And it's a bit like reading only poems to do with fish. You know, it's a slightly perverse thing to do. I don't just write about science, but I had quite an indecent number of poems about science and scientists in my first book, A Scottish Assembly, which came out in 1990. And it got to the stage where I felt obliged to kind of pull the rug from under my own feet on that. But here's a more straight-faced one called Photonics. We're a new technology, a system that weds lasers. No electronics, no gob drops of glass fibre to be teased and spun. Just conjugate phasing, turning constant signals into rings of light. A borough packed with brilliant marriages. Strong the way a tower block in an earthquake zone, rocks and quivers, floating erect on its bed of underground gravels. We're making discoveries, simplifying, unbuckling at the waist, unbuttoning the two pearl buttons at your throat, till we lie where the giant flung his shining causeway over gaunt blue water, into these small, sweet hills. We meet as clearly as two beams in a saltire, bonded at the centre, having each come through all the R&D to run on light. And lastly, a poem just called Scotland. This is possibly my most translated poem for the perverse reason that it has unusual vocabulary in it, but the vocabulary has become kind of internationally familiar vocabulary to do with the manufacture of semiconductors. There are some other elements of the poem that you probably will recognise, like that famous illuminated manuscript, medieval manuscript, the Book of Kells. The poem also mentions crow steps, which you get on the gables of houses, older houses in Scotland, which let people just walk up the gables as you would walk up steps to get to the chimney if your chimney went on fire. Scotland. Semiconductor country. Land crammed with intimate expanses. Your cities are super lattices, heterojunctive graph. From the air, your crop-marked farmlands are epitaxes of tweed. All night motorways carry your signal, swept to East Kilbride or Dunfermline. A brightness off low headlands beams in the dawn to Fife's interstices, optoelectronics of hay. Micronation, so small you cannot be forgotten, Bible inscribed on a rice grain, high-tech's key locked into the earth, your televised Glasgow's are broadcast in Rio, among circuit board crow steps. To be miniaturized is not small-minded. To love you needs more details than the Book of Kells, your harbors, your photography, your democratic intellect, still boundless, chip of a nation. I read a couple of poems from the book called Spirit Machines, which came out in 1999. These are from the title sequence, which is in memory of my father, who worked as a bank teller and grew up in rural Aberdeenshire. There are a number of poems in the book to do with the solid passing into the virtual, with money that is aspiring to the condition of spirit. If you think of that transition that is still going on, that move from the solidity of coinage to the dematerialized electronic transfer of wealth, or if you think about the sort of thing, although I hadn't read the book then, that Naomi Klein writes about in No Logo, you know, that movement from the kind of chunky, tangible processes of manufacture to the intangible Western obsession now with branding any product and with sheer image. This seems to me an interesting movement. And a number of the poems use notions of computing and the virtual as metaphors for the experience of bereavement and of faith. I was a very naive computer user and came late to using computers, so I often felt that I wanted, when something went wrong, to reach into the machine, you know, and sort it, which of course you can't do. But I was also struck by this sense of plenitude that comes with, say, going on to the web, and yet there's a simultaneous sense of there being at once plenitude and yet nothing's actually there. So this struck me as metaphorically useful for writing about the experience of bereavement, but also using as a metaphor almost, I suppose, for kinds of religious experience sometimes. First of these two poems from Spirit Machines is called Deincarnation, and it's about this move into the bodiless. It mentions several computing pioneers, but brings them all to the highlands of Scotland. Mentions a mountain, a great big mountain, called Rosheven in its course. Deincarnation. Each daybreak, laptops siphon off the glens. Ada, Countess of Lovelace, Vannevar Bush, Alan Turing, spectral in Scourie, Babbage downloading half of Sutherland with factors and reels, inescapable whirring of difference engines. Inverilert and Morar host shrewd pioneers of computing. Digitized blue massive Rosheven loses its substance, granite and grass, deincarnated and weightless. Shaking hands with absentees, beaters, gutters have their pockets emptied of any last objects, even a nanomachine, a pebble, a lucky coin. Skulking on Celtic twilight shores, each loch beyond is cleared of itself. Gaelic names, flora, rainfall, so close the tangible spirited away, cybered in a world of light. And this is a poem just about my father's life, which uses the internet as a way of going through his life, if you like. My father, neither of my parents went to university, and my father was not at all a bookish person. So one of the very few books of his that I inherited is called The Poultry Keeper's Vade Mecum, which, as its title suggests, is a book about how to keep hens. He kept and bred quite a lot of poultry in his teens when he grew up in a manse in Aberdeenshire, which had a big glebe, a big bit of land attached to it. He fought in the Scots Guards in the Second World War, so that comes into the poem. The poem mentions a BSA, which is a kind of motorbike. And there's a line in that there are a number of place names from rural Aberdeenshire, which, like the title of the poem, Afford, or Alford, as it looks on the page, is the name of a village round about where my dad grew up. There's a line of Greek comes in towards the end, and it is meant to sound alien, but it's translated in the line that follows, so it needn't be too disturbing. Afford. Blearily rummaging the internet, aged 38, not knowing where I was, I found a site designed as an old harled manse, sash windows opening on many Scotlands. Through one, surf broke on the West Sands, St Andrews, and through another, Glasgow mobbed George Square. Templeton carpets fluttered up and clucked. Crevecoeur, La Flèche, Azils, Minorcas, Cochangs, Langshans, Scots dumpies, Cornish game. The hall stand's canny, digitized gamp pointed to fading pixels. When I touched them, I felt the poultry keeper's vade mecum. Though in the next room, where a Bren gun spat, its title changed into King's Regulations, tanks manoeuvred round the hearth and range, smashing duck eggs, throwing up clouds of flour. Fleeing the earth-floored kitchen, an ironing table hurpled like girder work from bombed Cologne into the study where my Aunt Jean studied how not to be a skivvy all her life, while my dead uncle revved his BSA, wiping used, oily hands on Flanders lace. Ministers primed themselves in Jesus' Greek. Bankers shot pheasants. Girls sang. My father walked me through presses with a map of Paris, though all the names he used were Catons, Lochal, Tibberhenny, Afford, Don, Midmill. I understood. Virtual reality? I asked him. In reply, he looked so blank. His loved face was a fresh roll of papyrus waiting to be made a sacred text. Hands empty as the screen where he projected slides of our holidays at Ariseg. His body fresh cotton sheets in the best bedroom of his boyhood home before he was a boy. Waiting here, he waits to meet my mother for a first date at St. Martin in the Fields. Here his father, Robert, catches light on his own deathbed, pipe and press and journal combusting in a way none can control. Manse rooms huddle, fill with Shetland ponies, London tubes. There is no here. Here goes. Ente oikea puptu patros memonai polai eisen. In my father's house, are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. This poem is called Wind Farming. Wind farming has become very fashionable now. I went to a place whose name I liked, East Westphalia in Germany, and as the plane came into the airport, we flew over lots of these wind turbines, and I was kind of fascinated. I'd never seen so many of them close up before. But Scotland's aiming to generate by something like 2020, 40% of its electricity from wind turbines. I don't know if this is going to happen or not. And there have been a lot of arguments about, you know, siting wind turbines, say, in the Hebrides and in areas of great natural beauty. This poem, I say, called Wind Farming. Flailing outstretched cirrus fields, sleek metals throw up their hands, gleaning, milling where there is no corn in the agribusiness of air, totem-poled into acceleration's ultimate source and resource, propeller-driven crosses of the risen Christ, great ghosts of standing stones, while everything is speeding up, overheating, hurtling away, good to stand on this moonlit upland, canny, uncanny, with a choir of angels towering above us, beating their wings, piloting the earth on its way. And this is a poem, I suppose, partly coming out of thinking about DNA, but also thinking about a story about some of my ancestors whom I never knew and who did things at the wrong moment. It's called The Order, both in the sense of placing an order for something, but also in the sense of setting in order. The Order. After a partnership that failed near Drieghport, Glasgow, now at Yoker all went like a dream. The Order, a sleek-hulled steam yacht for a German client, due to be launched in late 1914. That was the spring my mother's uncle sweated and did not stop. He and his staggering wife went by unsteady train to Greenock West to be looked after by my grandmother, birthed in a tenement, enteric fever. He died, but the woman lived through the Great War, which, though she was not thought of at Versailles, stopped just 3 years before my mother's birth. And by the time her fluent pitman's shorthand reached 90 words a minute, a bomb fell, blitzing the Greenock flat she had just left. Next, it's my turn, part of the post-war years, leverets scooting, fast as twanged elastic, the shipyards closed, and like an open book, my young son can explain the human genome, letting me see in unassembled brass screws, handrails, greased pistons of an engine, bow wave and wake, the stranded DNA of boat building, that unbuilt yacht, the Order. I've been involved in a project which I will shamelessly leaflet you about now, which brings together a number of poets and scientists. You can tell in my day job I do something that involves giving out handouts. I can't resist this impulse. There are going to be a number of public events to do with this project, starting in London early next month. And what happened was that a poet and a scientist would sit down together and have lunch and just talk about what they did and similarities, differences in ways of working. But the scientist would also bring to the... And they had read a little bit about each other and each other's work before, and the scientist would bring to the lunch a provocative object, and the poet might just look at that or take it away. So I paired up with a biologist. I was keen to be paired with a biologist because I hoped that she would use the word strands at some point. And I had recently written that poem, and I was thinking about strands and stranded. But as it turned out, because she never used the word strands at all, so it was a real rather than a pre-programmed experience. This poem, which is called Biology, comes out of that meeting, that project, and is one great big long sentence, a kind of long strand of words. I don't think I've read it before aloud, in public anyway, so its length may make it slightly awkward. It doesn't go over the page, so don't get too worried, but it has a lot of trailing clauses. What the biologist let me take away was a pipette. Wasn't very exciting in some ways, and I was slightly disappointed. I said, "Do you want this back?" And she said, "Yes, I would actually. It cost £99.50." So I never had such an expensive pipette. So I took it home and played with it with my son, who had this phrase that he'd had that he'd said he'd wanted me to put into a poem. And the phrase, I can't remember where he'd got it, but the phrase was intermolecular embrace, a still unfolding book of Genesis. But one, like poetry, lost in translation. So most of us, to find the original sense, must call to mind some song our mother sang, one taken in with nursery rhymes and milk, then dream we come to love strange dialects, from Zymogen's to Avogadro's number, whose folk tales speak in strands of narrative, dense, trailing clauses scribbled by pipettes, enzyme legends, each a secret pathway through tiny mitochondric organelles, where carnitine, the label proteins read, acts out unseen, we recognition scenes. Atom-fine get-togethers, micro-bondings, pause and neg held in a cyclic shape, and there, in trees, in cats or human kidneys, articulates a sort of word-made flesh, goes recognized, unspoken, joins together mice, people, chuffs, so colourlessly proving gut feelings true, that all are held in one genetic myth, one Loch Ness deep, compelling, deft, intermolecular embrace. Big bang. Nice phrase, big bang. It's almost bin bag, but it's not quite. But somehow, or bing, you know, there are a number of other familiar phrases round about it, but it's striking how quickly this has established its own place in the language. So it would be ridiculous to line it up now with these other phrases so acoustically close. Big bang. I predate date. Stars are my smithereens, shattered ack-ack applause of no hands clapping, accelerated from a hard mass core's shotgunned argon, melding touch paper and ripcord, pulsars Catherine wheeling, going granular. Each comet bead spun in gaseous cosmic boil wash, galactic Corrie Vrechens, billion-mile-wide chrysanths seeded across a span that still awaits its planet's plenitude. Venus's moons, seared sore of solar flares flung at far Mars, sheer clouds of Milky Way, air, or sawtoothed Kulin Gabbro zigzag sky of sky. I should have said at the beginning that air and sky towards the end are A-Y-R and S-K-Y-E, in other words, the places in Scotland. I'll finish up by reading a poem about a scientist and explorer called William Spears, not really, it is, I suppose, partly about him, called William Spears Bruce, who was an Antarctic explorer who sailed on a ship called the Scotia, which went down to Antarctica between 1902 and 1904, a long voyage. And unlike people like Shackleton, he actually discovered a lot and did a lot of science, although he's rather forgotten. He appealed to me for a variety of reasons. He was from Dundee, and he'd sailed with the whaling fleet that went out of Dundee. And he wasn't out of the top drawer, and he tried to get this expedition funded by, I think, the Royal Geographical Society in London, and they wouldn't fund it, and he eventually got funding for it in Scotland and went off down to Antarctica. Norman McCaig used to be famous. When people would ask how long does it take you to write a poem, he would say, a cigarette. I'm tempted to give the absolute opposite kind of answer, but in a sense I wanted to write this poem for 20 years, but I'd wanted to write it about someone else. I met about 20 years ago someone who had worked for the British Antarctic Survey and been down in Antarctica while the Falklands War was on. And he'd gone down through South Georgia before the war started and then come back after the war when all the wildlife was much more frightened of humans and yeah, I've still got some photos that this guy gave me of, you know, the southern lights, not the aurora borealis, but the aurora australis. And I was very struck by his description. I read a book. There's a kind of standard book about South Georgia that I read, and I was very struck by his description of this chapel that is abandoned now, but had been used by Norwegian whalers, and their Norwegian prayer books were still lying in the pews, kind of rotting away. So I managed to feed some of this into the poem, although it's actually kind of remembering this man, William Spears Bruce, sailing in the Scotia 100 years ago. It's called Starcatcher. I've been writing a number of poems to do with stars. I suppose the Big Bang poem is to do with stars as well. Starcatcher. South of drowned Grytviken whalers, Norwegian prayer books. After endless dark sky carbon radiance, sun up. Over auroral ocean, one dawn sails, iced magnetic whiteness, crystal by crystal hauls down the Milky Way. Hidden between dense, crisscrossed, Dundee-sown albino threads, stars constellate in crisp, starched canvas, beadlets in close-grained weave, the Southern Cross, Castor and Pollux, sextantfuls and sackfuls of light, wind blown by big mid-morning trade winds, a universe hung out to dry. Noon, each trapped invisible stars, a tiny extraterrestrial berg, gleaming with pent-up Antarctic dazzle, secret all day as the small ships, blind, relentless, bow-wave battered figurehead plunges and rises towards night. Thank you.
Well, thank you to both of our speakers for those very interesting readings, which spoke, in fact, to each other on a variety of different and interesting levels. But I think I'll open up the floor now to questions from any of the audience. I may start actually kicking off with the first question. I wanted to ask Lisa, first of all, what impression do you have of the science of memory after your experience of research, going to various conferences in Europe and then translating that into a novel?
I think I have a lot of different impressions. I mean, it's not a singular world. It's not one entity. Mm-hmm. And there are, as you say, the sciences of memory. It's not just, you know, and I was really in one corner of it. I think I was left at the end, and in a sense that probably already came out from the bit that I read you, with the sense that although a great deal has been done within the scientific discourse, if you like, because they do translate it into language, after all, cellular work, and it's not easy to do. Mm-hmm. When they communicate it to me or to you, they're talking language. When you're looking like that, it's in a different element, or it's a different kind of material world. So I came away with a sense that there was still a great deal left to be done, and that perhaps the model of mind that on the whole the neuroscientists use as some kind of backdrop or underpinning for the research that they do is probably not as complex a model of the mind as that which we all inhabit. Now, there are reasons for this, and I can come very quickly to the others inside and say, well, you know, I'll talk about this a bit tomorrow, that in fact there's so much complexity already there at the sub-microscopic level that, you know, all that other stuff is too much to put together into one set of ideas. But since most of us live this complication without necessarily having recourse to the biological at every step, like my character tries to do, it's not quite enough. It doesn't quite yet answer a great many of the questions that we have, particularly about forgetting. I mean, you know, in a sense, the learning model, the memory model, is the one that they've done most work on. Learning is a stage in memory, of course. But forgetting is harder. What we forget and why we forget and when we remember what we've forgotten is very tricky. And you know, neuroscientists will get very vague when you talk to them about that. As vague as I get, talking about it from another area. Yeah.
Question up at the back. I'm going to tell you to read the book
because it's a very, very big question. I mean, I guess in a sense, because the starting points are slightly different. I mean, most scientists will work either with animals or with matter, slices of tissue, and then to make the leap from that into what is, after all, human society. Well, first of all, the level of the organism, i.e., you know, the entire human being, let alone the entire rat, or chick, or whatever it happens to be, and then to move from that into society, political society, cultural society, is huge. I don't think... it's very, very difficult to encompass. And we're sometimes fooled into thinking that they have, because, like electricity, some of these chemical products, pharmaceuticals that people come up with, work. Or seem to have an effect, but that effect is not necessarily related to a cause, or directly related to a cause. I'm probably not making any sense now, but I could unpack that at great length, but I don't think I want to do that now. Can we save it for tomorrow? Because it's quite, it's tricky terrain. But I'm full of respect for the neuroscientists. I mean, I didn't necessarily have that in the same way before. I hope I didn't give the impression that I wasn't. I was just trying to, you know, work the two.
There's a question over there.
Yes, the latter, I think. That's why I'm sort of in a sense, it's somehow phony to stand up and just read all these poems about science, because when, although in the case of the biology poem, you know, the idea was to try and generate a poem that had to do with science, usually that's not the way a poem arrives. It usually arrives from a number of different directions, and one of them might have to do with some piece of scientific knowledge or reading or conversation. So the science kind of comes in, although for some reasons purely personal, and for other reasons more to do with language, and sort of, you know, there's a tradition, if you like, of writing poems to do with science that would run through John Davidson, Hugh McDermott, Edwin Morgan, which I am very attracted to. So I'm kind of aware of that. But there's also almost a quality, which some people will be suspicious of aureate diction, if you like, that the scientific, in the way that, say, a medieval poet like William Dunbar would use this kind of golden language, you know, fancy language, often rather Latinate language that he would put into his poetry. And that notion of aureate diction, the kind of aureate diction attraction to some scientific terminology, but at the same time it seems very cold. It struck me that those dictionary passages were partly blankings out of emotion.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to... I mean, that in fact is the use the character puts them to.
Yes, I think I'm quite attracted to trying to use scientific images and material in a more charged and lyrical way, and to bring them up against emotional language, as you were doing in I think the piece that you read. But I'm particularly attracted to doing the sort of thing that some scientists, and say a great poet scientist like Miroslav Hollow, didn't approve of, which is to use the science metaphorically to talk of emotion, or to talk of religious experience or whatever. Now, I'm aware that a lot of people think this is very naughty, but in a sense that's particularly the challenge that attracts me. That's what attracts me to doing this.
Robert, do you think there are some scientists that lend themselves more easily to that?
Some scientists?
Some sciences.
Sciences.
Yes, I mean, I think physics lends itself...
Right.
Well, yeah. Perhaps not, I'm not sure.
Well, yes, I mean, some of the poems that I read early on, ones to do with semiconductors, came out on photonics, came out of laser physics. And, you know, I wasn't doing this deliberately, but I ended up reading poems about stars. Now, I think part of the attraction of laser physics for me was the sheer lyrical attractiveness of light. Yes. But on the other hand, that wouldn't be there in biological sciences particularly, although one might think that biological sciences would be more poetry-friendly than, say, laser physics. But an awful lot of science has metaphorical potential
absolutely,
in it.
Absolutely.
and has, you know, and I know there have been a lot of arguments about this, but, you know, maybe even be structured on kinds of metaphor.
I think that's right, but I think what happens is the pharmaceuticals then come in, and the pharmaceuticals are not poetry friendly or metaphor friendly.
No.
Mm-hmm. And they have acronyms.
Yes, yeah. Well, this biologist I worked with, she was supposed to. Not quite pharmaceutical, but, you know, she wrote all these papers about something called carnitine, and I thought carnitine sounded a bit like someone who might be a prince in a children's fairy story or something. You know, I found it very, very hard to, couldn't read these papers, but was rather fascinated that she thought she could just mail me them and I would understand them, which I couldn't. So it was only when we had lunch and I had it explained to me, you know, I said, could you explain this to me as if I were an 8-year-old child? And she was very good at doing that. Slightly frustrated, I think, to have to do it, but good at doing it. That was only when she explained to me that way that I could start to see what might be going on.
There's another question in the middle.
I found it quite difficult to do the lexicon, I have to say, and I decided, as I was doing, you know, when I decided that the book wanted it and that it served a useful function within the kind of the drama of the book or the conflicts of the book. I thought I have to do this very, very cold and as a, you know, beginner's guide to. And it's actually quite hard to, I mean, I don't write science, I'm not a science writer. It's very hard to write it so that it's clear and comprehensible and yet doesn't immediately put me to sleep. Because I'm not a science reader either. I mean, of course, you read, you know, some of the great science writers write as well as any novelist, or better sometimes, and are full of metaphorical, wondrous language. But that's not what he's doing. He's actually trying to explain, and explanatory language is always quite difficult, I think. Sorry, now I've gone away from the question. I've forgotten the first part of it. I've gone into the Linz lexicon. Is that enough? Yeah, I think what happened with this book is that I had an idea of the terrain that the book was going to cover, sort of working away, you know, inside my head somewhere. And then, in a sense, the neurological character came along as a very useful and interesting character to explore some of that other material. And yes, it's always a tricky line between research and narrative. But, you know, I think more and more, a lot of the fiction that I read uses research quite blatantly. And I find this quite interesting, that we all kind of want it as readers, as well as wanting, you know, the other stuff, the stories and the characters and the language, if that's the kind of novelist you are. And I don't know whether it's a kind of growing sophistication in readers and writers, or whether it's just a hunger for kind of encyclopedic things. But I find it more and more. I mean, so yeah, you can display it more, particularly if it's bracketed either with a kind of irony or I don't know, in my case, in boxes.
Another question about that. Oh, maybe it's not. Okay. I think we have time maybe for one more question, or maybe we could. I'm going to actually then ask the last question, because that's my privilege as chair. I want to ask a question, a very quick and perhaps rather flippant question to Robert. What inspired the Einstein poem?
The poem is called Alba Einstein, Alba being an old word name for Scotland. I may be fabricating, it's quite a long time since I might be fabricating this answer. I think I'd gone to do a reading in a school. And
this is real.
Well, that's it. You see, I can't quite remember, but I think I did a reading in a school and I made some joke about there are a lot of poems in the book about Scottish scientists, Clark Maxwell and Logie Baird, and scientists and technologists. And I think I made some off the cuff remark about what I really wanted was for Einstein to have been Scottish. And I remember, I think, sitting in a railway station, kind of thinking, and so the poem came from that, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'd like to thank both of our speakers again. Before you leave, I just have a couple of very brief announcements. When you go out of the theatre, opposite you will find outside the conference room a display set up by the bookshop with copies of both Lisa's most recent books and also Robert's publications, which will be available for you to buy. If you take along your ticket, you get a 10% discount, so that's an added incentive for you to go and have a look. Also, both Lisa and Robert have very kindly agreed that they will be around here for a few minutes now to answer any further questions people may have, but also to sign copies of these books, if that's what you would like. I'd just like to thank very much the Humanities Research Centre and also the Writers at Warwick programme for making this event possible tonight. And I'd like to remind conference delegates that there will be a wine reception after this event in the Humanities Building. So you're free to make your way over there on your own if you wish, or I will be leading a party over in a few moments. So once again, thank you very much to Lisa and Robert.
Thank you.